after Amulek and Alma had witnessed that auto da fe, that horrible thing, which I assure you is quite routine in religious history. The irony, isn't it? They're all religious, these auto da fes. The burning of women and children and books in big piles, it's happened not once, but hundreds of times. It happened anciently, too, the story of Cyrus and then they found themselves in the jail. And they got some rough treatment there. It's a sort of an SS prison here. And the judge comes to Alma and Amulek, and they keep hitting him in the face, which is the usual procedure to get a person to talk. They slap him, you know. Well, after what you've seen, will you preach again, they say. Now, the hardest test of all is holding back, you see. It's not blowing up or doing violence. And this is the test to which they're being subjected now in any action, you see. And this is where the Latter-day Saints historically have been repeatedly tested and stood up to the test very well. The times they didn't go to war were the times they always won. Then the other times when they blew their tops, Cherry Creek, something like that, was not so good. But Alma's being tested here to the breaking point. He says, "Ye, behold, you had not the power to save those, you had not, neither did God have the power to save them. You saw what happened," and so forth. This judge was after the manner of Nehor. Notice, Nehor's is a permanent establishment. It begins way back, the first chapter of Alma here. And he was of the order of Nehor, but Alma and Amulek answered nothing. Hey, that was the severe test. They've been cast into the prison 2 days. Then the lawyers and judges came to work on them in the manner of the SS. We do this, police states and so forth. We do this in the manner, and they were all professors of Nehor, too. It was a religious persecution because the priests came along, the lawyers and the judges, the priests and the teachers. This is religious persecution here, the establishment. And the burning was, you see, an auto da fe, after all. But he answered nothing. That's infuriating. And they came again on the morrow. They still work on him. "How shall we look when we are damned?" they say. See, they are losing control now. They're getting funny here. This is a Galgen humor, so to speak. And this thing went on for many days. Remember, they mocked Jesus for a long time. And the story tells us, the testament tells us, that they made mockery of him. They made mockery of the gospel. Well, you do not mock a figment of your imagination. You do not mock a legend or an abstraction. That's one of the proofs that Jesus really lived, the fact that mockery was what was left behind in the early Christian times. I'd say, you may hold another person's view in contempt or something like that, but if the person never really lived, you wouldn't mock him, of course, as an abstraction or as a spiritual essence or teaching. That mockery is an important part. It brings that element of reality into the New Testament that people often ignore. Well, here's the old chestnut, see? If you have the power of God, deliver yourself from these bands. Of course, they asked Jesus to bring himself down from the cross if he could. And, of course, they ask for a sign. And they all went and smote him again, and this routine goes on until Alma and Amulek have had about enough, and they rose and stood on their feet, and Alma cried out, saying, "How long shall we suffer these great afflictions, O Lord?" And they broke the bonds, which they could not have done by their own strength, and the people saw that. And they were terrified and tried to put as much distance as they could between Alma and Amulek. So what did they do? They all made for the gate. There was a rush. There was an earthquake. Notice, miracles are in the timing, not in the event. This was earthquake country. Not surprising that there was an earthquake, but just at that moment was when it was helpful, you see. And they all made a rush for the gate, and so naturally they crowded the exit, they jammed the exit, nobody could get out, the gate collapsed, and they were all killed there. The only safe people are Alma and Amulek, who stayed behind. See, they tried to get as far from them as they could. Well, that's what exactly what happened in 1906 in Pelé. A city of, was it 8,000 or 80,000? 8,000 people was utterly destroyed. Only one survivor in the great debacle at Pelé in 1906, and that was a prisoner who was in the deepest dungeon in town. That was the only place to be safe. The only safe place was to be in the dungeon. The one safe place for Alma and Amulek. They weren't touched because they stayed behind, it says. The people all rushed for the gate, jammed together, got themselves killed the way they do when a crowd panics, because they were panicky, you see. And the teachers who smote upon Alma and Amulek were slain by the fall thereof. It describes it, see. They fell to the earth. They did not obtain the outer door of the prison. The earth shook mightily. You see what a time of panic it was. And then, as I say, it's the timing, not the event. We can think of the thundering legion and the Red Sea and the flooding of the Jordan and the quail at Sugar Creek and the like. Think of all the wind changes, the Protestant wind, all these miracles that happen. They're ordinary events that happen, but at a very convenient time, you see. This is the way it goes. And this was a very convenient one, too. Of course, the miraculous part is the Lord can foresee it. He arranges our affairs. He manages it. We'll be there when it happens, as far as that goes. So every soul, notice, in the walls thereof, save it were Alma and Amulek, perished. Because they were, I say, by themselves in their own dungeon. They've been left there alone. Well, when the great crash in the prison came down, the people all came running together as he was going on, you see. And when they saw Alma and Amulek emerging, they ran too. They were terrified at the sight. And so they proceeded calmly to the land of Sidon, in the next chapter. Move on. And you notice we get these forced separations of people are very important, especially in religious history. Notice the people, all the people of Ammonihah was going to be completely destroyed, but all the people that wanted to follow Ammon or Amulek in the city of Ammonihah, they were driven out. They were forced to go out and settle elsewhere, and they did, and it says there they found the land of Ammonihah, who had been cast out and stoned because they believed in Alma. And they were in another city, the city of Sidon. They settled there, you see. And these forced migrations. 1492, when all the Jews were driven out in the year out of Spain, or when all the saints were driven out of Missouri, it's the best thing that could have happened, because after that, then came the bloody soil, the bloody shirt, bloody Kansas, and so forth, Lawrence, the Jayhawkers, and the Bullwhackers, the Jayhawkers, great mobs destroying each other, the whole land torn by riots. There were more killings than ever were when the Mormons were there. Mormons just got out in time. There was a forced separation. Or, the best yet, in 1685, when Louis XIV drove all the Huguenots out of France, all the Protestant Huguenots had to leave France on a certain day. Just like the following the St. Bartholomew's Eve. Well, they went to the Netherlands, and they went to Prussia, especially, and they went to England, and made those countries very rich and prosperous because they were the most intelligent and industrious people in Europe with those Huguenots. And it was a landfall for Prussia, of course. It just fell into the lap there. And that's what gave Frederick the Great his background. That's why you find so many French names in Berlin and so forth. Well, anyway, there are others. It's like 1847, Pinasse, the driving out of the Waldenses. They were driven and the Vaudois and so forth. They went and settled elsewhere, and everywhere they brought prosperity wherever they went. It's an interesting thing. Well, so Zizrom, they go, Zizrom is there in Sidon. It's a safe place for these people, you see. People are, Sidon is a tolerant city, apparently. And Zizrom was there, and he's sick of a burning fever. See, he is obsessed with guilt, which drove him out of his mind. His fever was actually an escape. He wanted to die here. This great sin harrowed him up, harrowed up his mind. He couldn't stand it. Therefore, he was scorched with a burning fever. The fever was part of his sickness. He, as if he'd brought it on himself. They went to the house of Zizrom, the brethren did, and found him on his bed. And when he saw them, saw there was a chance of life, and he asked to be healed by them. His mind was also exceeding sore. See, he was out of his mind. He was having terrible mental anguish because of the things he'd done and so on. And this was the cause of his sickness. This will bring it on every time. So he asked them to heal him. When he saw the brethren, he asked them to heal him. By the power of Christ unto salvation, he says, believest thou the power of Christ unto salvation. See what that means? It means, as it says in the 8th verse, unto redemption. Well, he's sick on the point of death and destruction, but salvation is to be saved from any dire condition you're in, from any desperate end to which you might come. The power of Christ will save you. And he says, here he is right in the depths. He says, to believe in the power of Christ to save you is what he's saying. You believe that Christ can save, the power of Christ unto salvation. And he answered and said, I believe all the words I was taught. This means if you believe it, you can come back, they say. So if thou believest, see, in the redemption, that's calling you back again. Redemo means to buy back, let you in again, take you back home again, prodigal son. He'll do it as long as you repent, as long as you're here, he can do it. Redemption, he says, according to the faith. Now, according to his faith, is faith the power that does that, or is it Jesus Christ, or what? Well, faith is the power that plugs us in. It's not the power, but I say it plugs us into the circuit, so to speak. The power is always there. We're surrounded by this enormous amount of power all the time. And by applying faith, we make it accessible to us. We make it useful for us. We're able, as I say, to plug in, to use a vulgar expression, but that's the sort of thing you do. You open your minds to faith, and then you're able to do it. And remembering this, all this was done in great astonishment of all the people. Knowledge went forth throughout the land of Sidon. He arose on his feet and began to walk. But remember, Alma was just as guilty as Zizrom was. Alma, who saved him, had been just as guilty. He'd done just as dirty things, and he had less reason to, as a matter of fact, because his father was the head of the church, as far as that goes, and Zizrom's father wasn't. He was just the same. So Zizrom decides to walk. But remember, this tremendous power that surrounds us. I talked about that new thing they talk about, this bosun that everybody's looking for. The two biggest atom machines being built are being built to discover that one thing, that one power that envelops everything else and which all the other particles have derived and so forth. And they call it the Driggs boson. Alma baptized Zizrom, and then he began to preach to the people, and he established a church there, and they flocked from all the region. They were very successful, say. But as to Ammonaha, the city these people had left, they remained hard-hearted, couldn't move them at all. They were the rooted in the profession of Nehor. What was it that made this Nehor business so appealing anyway? Oh, we saw back there in Alma 1 and 3, following the first chapter of Alma, it tells us. It was ceremonial, it was soothing, it was undemanding, it was flattering. Well, that's the kind of religion you want. You can rationalize anything you want there, and this was there. And that was very religious, very pious, these people, defined with the Zoramites. And here's this very pointed pact, 16. You see, Amulek, remember, telling what a rich, important man he was. Everybody envied him, all Oedipus. And he was the blue blood of the city, direct descendant of Nephi, highly respected by his labor. It made himself very rich. Everybody thought a lot of him. But to go out with Alma, he got rid of all his swag, and this is what happened. Amulek, having forsaken all his gold and silver and his precious things, which were in the land of Ammonaha for the word of God, he being rejected by those who were once his friends, and also by his father and his kindred. Not only his friends cut him off cold when he didn't have any more money, his family cut him off cold when he didn't have any more money. Well, he got his money by hard work and so forth. They were doing the right thing. I guess they all clamored to get the dough, then they all went to court. When my best friend, Paul Springer, he was a chief reporter in San Francisco for many years, and he's on the city council in San Francisco. He joined the church for a while. He loved his cigars and champagne. He's still having a time with it. Well, he's almost as old as I am. But he was in charge of the courts, of the testating courts for testing wills and so forth. And what people would do for money. How people would become mortal enemies in a very rich family over a thing like a piano stool or something like that. This desire to possess, this greed, he says. The greed that you see in these courts where they try to claim the property, the testament, who will get the most, who will get the diamond ring, and who will get even a pair of used shoes. I mean, they would cut each other's throats for what people do when they go after material things. It's astounding, isn't it? Well, you see, that's real psychology here. Amulek got rid of his money. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with him anymore. Thereafter, having established a church in Sidon, so they did that, and the people assembled themselves together to worship in sanctuaries before the altar. Notice, this is the kind of cult they have here. It's true. In the law of Moses, the altar is not necessary for sacrifice, but the altar is necessary. It's very interesting. In Exodus 30, for example, it tells us, the primary purpose of that altar isn't for sacrifice, but as we use it in the temple, it's a center, it's a centering for activities in the temple. Of course, an altar is where you bring things, an altar is where you receive things. It's a table, you see. A table is where you share things, to which you bring things and to which you take things. And it's around the table, and that's what altar is, after all. They began to assemble themselves together at their sanctuaries to worship before the altar, it says. Here, watching, and this is, of course, in the ancient world, they had them everywhere. Watching and praying continually that they might be delivered from Satan, from death, and from destruction. So the church was established and running in this place. And now I said, Alma took Amulek back home to his own house. They're going to take a rest now. And they no sooner get back, they're not back very long, when there suddenly war comes. Suddenly, on the second month of the 11th, the cry of war was heard throughout the land. Now, this is interesting because Clausewitz assures us that war can never start suddenly like this or anything like that. But this started suddenly. This started all of a sudden. But what it was, what kind of a run, it was a typical Lamanite war. It was a ghazza. See, our word raid comes out, but ghazza. It's a raid for slaves. It was a slave raid. So you burst surprises everything here, you see. And the whole purpose is that. Now, if you look, for example, in verse 5, he goes, where he went to know whether he should go. into the wilderness in search of their brethren who'd been taken captive. Their whole purpose, see, they didn't stay and fight. They went off with the brethren, and now Alma's going to pursue them. He's going to chase them. Yes, it is Alma. He's going to chase them in search of the brethren, the captives, to bring them back again. And then the next verse, it says the same thing. See, at the end of the next verse, the Lord will deliver thee, thy brethren, who have been taken captive by the Lamanites. So the only purpose, it was a slave raid, and which is the main purpose of barbaric wars most of the time. And again, you see, when it is completed, we have here in the, at the end here, we have where they get the slaves back. Yet here, in the 8th verse, the Lamanites were scattered and driven into the wilderness, and they took their brethren who had been taken captive by the Lamanites, and there was not one soul among them who was lost. So it was a slave raid, and they got the slaves back, but they had the help of the Lord in doing it so that it wouldn't grow to a large and nasty war. So it tells us here, behold, the armies of the Lamanites upon us, that's the way you do it. They swept down on the city of Ammonihah, they wiped that out. And now it came to pass before the Nephites knew what was happened, they destroyed Ammonihah. They came to the borders of Noah, taking others captive into the wilderness. Now it came to pass to the Nephites were desirous, this is the point, see, were desirous, well, here's another case, were desirous to obtain those who had been carried away captive to the wilderness. That was the issue, see, it was slaves. Therefore, they appointed a captain, and his name was Zoram. That name means refreshing rain, a strong rain. After a dry winter, after a drought, when you have a strong rain, it's called a Zoram. So it's a popular name with these people, you'd expect it. Zoram, he had two sons, Lehi and Ahah. There's an interesting theme, because that's a Jaredite name too, because Ahah in Egyptian means warrior. And they were warriors too, Lehi and Ahah. That's a very common name. The first king of Egypt was called Ahah. That was one of his epithets. He was Ahah, the warrior. Though it's always written by a pair of arms holding a shield, one holding a club and one holding a shield, and that's the name Ahah. It means a leader in war. And Zoram went to Alma. He went to Alma to know whether the Lord, whether they should go into the wilderness in search of their brethren. Now, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you don't want to slow down, but in the 15th section, section 23, column 15 in section 23, it tells about that the high priest is asked. He is the one who's inspired of the Lord, and before Israel goes to war, as remember our Dead Sea Scrolls, they could consult the high priest, you see. It's like casting the lot or so forth, the way you have to do in other countries. But you consult the Lord if you do, and he does that here. He consults the high priest to ask where they should go in search of their brethren. See, that's what the operation is to be a search and rescue, not a search and destroy, a search and rescue. And that's what they do. They inquire the Lord, they go, they find where they are, and he tells them what the plan was. They nip the plan in the bud. He says, Alma returned and said, behold, the Lamanites will cross the riverside and in the south wilderness, where they were least expected, you see, beyond the borders of the land, Manti, and there ye shall meet them. See, there's, and on the east of the river Sidon, and the Lord will deliver unto thee thy brethren who have been captive. And that's the whole thing. Well then, here this was the cursed town. We skip down to verse 9, the cursed town of the Ammonite, all of them destroyed. One was left. In one day, it was left desolate. And here's an interesting thing. They're going to give it a name. They're going to call it desolation. Nevertheless, after many days, the dead bodies and so forth. Now so great was the scent thereof that the people did not go into the possession of the land of Ammonihah for many years, and it was called desolation of the Nehors. For they were the profession of Nehor that were slain, and their lands remained desolate. I told you before that Awatabi, the greatest of all the Hopi villages, when it was burned, nobody ever goes back there. I mean, it's desolation. And the interesting thing you read in Numbers 21, when the king of Arad, raids Israel for slaves, he does the very same thing. And he runs away with them, and the Israel's, the Lord tells, justifies Samuel to go out and chase him and pursue him and catch him and destroy the land. And Arad's kingdom was destroyed, and they changed the name to Hormah, desolation. See? So here it is. After you've desolated a country, you change it to Hormah. Now, we read in the Romans have the same thing, the Arabs have the same thing, the Hebrews have the same thing. The good land is the land bountiful. You call it a bountiful, it's a fruitful land and so forth. But a land that's been destroyed is called Hormah or Horeb, either one. Horeb means desert and Hormah means, Haram is the word for war, you see, it's the Arabic word for war, Harma, desolation. Harma means desolation and Horeb means the same thing. It means desolation, destruction. And a land that has been destroyed is dedicated to desolation, and usually the name is changed to Horeb or Horam. And the Romans would sow it with salt, and then it was Agar Hosticus. Could not be planted again. became unfertile, deserted, and so forth. So this is a Book of Mormon custom, the land desolation. You see, there's lots of desolation and lots of land bountiful here. And their lands remain desolate there. Well, Amulek and Amulek go forth then, preaching repentance to the people in their temples and their sanctuaries and in their synagogues. This interesting reference to synagogues, let's mention this here in the 31st verse. A Jew will tell you, well, isn't that premature? The synagogue didn't exist until after the fall of the temple. The temple is where the Jews met. After that, they met in the synagogue. The synagoge is the Greek name for it. It simply means the place where you assemble, the kahal, the church, the assembly place. But it was no less a person than Solomon Sightline, who became editor of the Jewish Quarterly Review for many, many years. Old Solomon Sightline, his doctoral dissertation was on that subject. He investigated and found that synagogues were just as common before the fall of the temple as after the fall of the temple, because Jews living in distant places, they formed their own society. They couldn't call them temples, they said, because there's only one temple for them to go to. They were all required to go up to Israel, the house of the Lord, once a year to worship the Lord. That was at the end of Zechariah. Upon anyone who doesn't go up there with his family and everybody else and bring his offerings, upon them shall be no rain. That was the curse. But they had to have their meetings and their assemblies, and they elected their leaders and so forth. And this wasn't just after the temple fell. They had these synagogues long before. And it was as early as the 4th century BC. Well, quite early they started calling them synagogues, as far as that's the name they went by. Because where the Jews settled was in non-Jewish country. And remember, the Jewish Hellenistic culture, they adopt other cultures, but especially the Greek. In fact, the best and oldest text we have, the Old Testament, is the Greek Septuagint. So don't worry about synagogues. That's not an anachronism. And so Amalek went forth, and also many more went forth to preach. So they start a motion going. You see, others go forth to preach after their example in the 15th verse. And so they established the church throughout all the land. It became general throughout the land. Oh, this is wonderful. All the people of the Nephites. This movement spread, and there was no inequality among all the people. Whoever thought it would end up that way? And it was still preparation. It was still there. We are still being prepared. Prepared to meet the minds of the... prepared the minds of the children of men to prepare their hearts to receive the word. We're still being prepared. We haven't gone all the way, you see. At the time of his coming. Well, that was to be 78 years later. Well, and... and you go, and a branch, one of the branch should be grafted to the true vine. Now, those priests who did go forth among the people in the 18th verse here, did preach against, this is what they preached against, of course, the things that are bad in society, all lyings and deceivings and envyings, what is wickedness again, this sort of thing. Things are interesting, and strifes and malice, and notice, what one word would you use to cover all this? I would say meanness, inhumanity. Notice if you, well, the Lord, remember the Lord told the apostles, he says, there are two commandments on which all laws and the prophets hang. If you keep them, don't worry about the others. The first is, thou shalt love the Lord thy God, as you know, with all your heart and mind. The second is, like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And if you do that, you'll have not the slightest desire or inclination to break any of the other commandments. You won't commit murder, or you won't steal, or you won't lie if you love your neighbor as yourself. And that goes for everybody. And so, this is what they're preaching. Notice it's this meanness. Notice very few of these things are against the law. You can't put a person in prison for these things. And yet these are the real sins, see? People lie all over the place. I mean, you can't sell anything without lying, they tell me. And deceiving, if you're trying to buy a car, a house, under some people. And envyings, did you ever hear about a competitive system and so forth? And strifes, that's competition, you see? And malice, you're going to get even. There's lots of getting even going on. Don't get mad, get even. And revilings, you see? And, well, then the stealing and the robbering and plundering and murdering. Oh, it's getting serious. It gets more serious as we go, doesn't it? And murdering and committing adultery and all manner of lasciviousness. Well, we are experts in lasciviousness today. Crying, all these things ought not to be so. Well, apparently they were so. They're straightening the people out now. Holding forth the coming of the Son of God, his suffering and death, and also the resurrection of the dead. Christians see this in the Old Testament prophets. And now the... having victory over the devil now. Well, and concerning the place, many of the people inquired. They naturally wanted to know, since the coming of Christ was the big thing, where will he come and when will he come? Will we get to see him concerning the place? And where he would appear to them? Yes, he will appear to you after the resurrection. Well, that satisfied them. He wouldn't appear to them here, but after the resurrection he would, they were told there. And now, after the church had been established, having got victory over the devil, it's the ideal, and God being preached in purity in the land, and it was the end of the 14th year. Now, this is a good time to send out missionaries to the Lamanites, so that's what they're going to do. Everybody at home sort of getting brought into line. And so now, Alma was journeying in the wilderness, and he finds his missionary brethren out there. Might have been gone a long time. How long has it been? No, not so terribly long. But a typical travel event, you know, when you meet your old friends after all these years. Well, of all people, the three sons of Mosiah. Yes?
In verse 13, in the chapter we just went through, it mentions three things. It mentions temples, synagogues, and sanctuaries.
Sanctuaries, yes.
Now, is there any kind of a difference between temples and synagogues and when they talk about sanctuaries?
Yes, the sanctuary isn't a full-scale temple, and it's not a meeting place either. It's just a place where holy things can be held on. Well, like something like a bishop's storehouse, or we have minor ones. A temple is a big church, and a synagogue is a place where the whole society meets. Well, they're in between. Now, as you know, it's very typical to have shrines. Do we have shrines in the church today? What kind of shrines do we have, incidentally? We have places we visit, like Nauvoo, you know, the Hill Cumorah, the Sacred Grove, and so forth. Those aren't shrines. Yes, there are places that are treasured and so forth. They're not particularly magical. They're not regular meeting places, as temples and churches are. But they're a place that are set aside, a place that's set aside as something special. We have them, we keep them that way. We usually, if we want to put up a service station or a bank, we make short work of them, of course. But so they're not actually, they could be dedicated buildings as far as that goes. Take the Colville Tabernacle, tore it down. Well, let's not get started on that. But you see, we have architectural gems throughout the state, some real beauties that have been torn down because they were not cost productive. Well, the old Salt Lake Theater, the committee, I was with President Grant and some of the members when they were discussing it. I was just a kid, but I was sitting on the side listening. President Grant says, "How sorry are you to see it go?" He says, I'm sorry enough to pay $5,000 to restore it. They argued and argued, decided we should torn down anyway. And my grandfather got me into that session and so forth. But it's a very interesting thing there that you bring that up. Do we have shrines? It's an interesting question. You better write a thesis on it or write a paper on it at least. I don't think anybody's looked into it. How holy can a building be before it's immune from destruction? Well, they journey and they meet their old brethren, you see. And notice what they were. They were men of sound understanding, and they searched the scriptures diligently. That sound understanding, notice they were not hysterical or theatrical or fanatical or evangelical types at all. They were men of sound mind and sound understanding, and they searched the scriptures. That's what you go by. And they fasted and prayed, and therefore they had the spirit of prophecy and the spirit of revelation. It does not supersede the scriptures, you notice. They search the scriptures, and therefore the two go together, always go together, which we mentioned the last time. They had been teaching, now here's how long they've been, 14 years among the Lamanites. They were really dedicated. When they went on their mission, they went. And they had many afflictions in body and mind. The mission suggested, it was our missions, remember, that suggested the Peace Corps in Kennedy's day. But missionaries sometimes have to take a beating, and we have it rather easy today. But I know some had a pretty rough time. They had refused the kingdom, remember? They were the king's sons. They were eligible. They were in line for the throne. They don't have to have a republic now. How did they support themselves? Well, they took spears and bows and provided food for themselves as one. They went without person script. They fed their way. Naturally, they visited towns and villages and were fed by the people, and because they made many contacts and so forth. This happens too. And with their numbers, which they had selected to go up to the land of Nephi, thus they departed, and a troop went up to the land of Nephi. And the Lamanites. Now, they're going to convert the Lamanites. This is going to be a hard thing. The people of Ammonihah were bad enough. But here, if it were possible, their brethren, the Lamanites, to a knowledge of the truth, a knowledge of the baseness of their traditions and their fathers, which were not correct. Now, what are the chances of convincing them of that, you see? I see in the next chapter, where it says 27, 28, they talk about those traditions. Very interesting what we come to here. And the Lord visited them with his spirit. The what about these traditions here, 18 and 4? Yes. Now the king heard the words and said, I know not. Now I know that it is the Great Spirit. He has come down to preserve us, that I might not slay you, that I might not slay you as I did your brethren. Now this is they talk about the Great Spirit later on. We're going to see that. There's going to be a lot of talk about the Great Spirit, which is very important for us today, about the Great Spirit. Well, they went, and the Spirit of the Lord visited them. They went to the Lamanites, and they had some success, but it took a lot of patience and suffering and good examples. It says in the 12th verse, they took courage. And then they decided they could be more effective if they could spread out. There'd be more of them, cover more ground. So they separated themselves and went alone. Assuredly. Now, this is a wonderful description. This is about the best summarizing the description of Lamanite civilization as you can get here in the 14th verse here. The combination of qualities here. See, we've come to regard the acquisition of riches and finery as a mark of civilization. On the contrary, it's a mark of barbarism, of course, as you read in Beowulf and so forth. They're not a gauge of civilization, but the opposite. An Egyptian or a Mayan procession, what a difference between them. The Egyptians, everyone, including the king, very simply dressed. A simple basic white slip will do for the nobility and so forth. But if you've seen the way the Mayan and the Aztec nobility got themselves up, I mean, a walking Christmas tree is no exaggeration. Some of you may have gone to the war talks the other night and seen that very good talk by the major on armor, on Lamanite Nephite armor. But there were some good drawings from vases and murals and so forth showing the grandees, the great people, the priests, and the nobility. And their dress was utterly absurd. It was so overdone. They were so heavily laden with feathers and jewels and especially jade and things like that. It was absurd here. That's barbaric, you see, to load yourself down with all your junk. For one thing, barbarians are on the march most of the time. They have to carry their wealth with it, so they have to have it portable. So you put it in gold, and the women wear it around their necks. They wear as many as 10, 13 strings of gold coins around their necks. That's the way you have to do it, because it's going to have to be on the move all the time. So they love gold and jewels, because gold and jewels are portable. And the sedentary arts, like architecture and literature, but they have arts. They have their highly developed arts that require the use of the mind, because you can carry that with you. They have to be very good at mathematics, at star watching, very good at poetry. They memorize enormous poetry. They're the authors of epic poetry. Long poetry, people that have to keep on the move all the time, they take their treasures with them where they can carry them in their heads, in their hearts. So there's something to be said for both civilizations. The sedentary civilization stews after a while, becomes rotten Babylonian, soft and decayed, and then the others overrun it. Plant it, then they start decaying the same way. It's a routine that's been followed forever and ever. Well, it says here, they had undertaken to preach the word of God to a wild and hardened and ferocious people who delighted in murdering the Nephites. They delighted in that, and robbing and plundering them. And their hearts were set, just like the Nephites themselves, notice, their hearts were set on riches or upon gold and silver and precious stones. I say exactly what these people would covet. The wealthy display, elegance, you know. They sought to obtain these things by murder. Well, and plunder you directly the way, after all, what is the subject of murder and plunder? And most of, if you flip through the TV channels, it's jewels. It's jewels or else it's some pleasure, but usually it's the emeralds or it's the pearls or whatever it is, because that's the thing that you can carry around with you. That's the thing you can put in your pocket and so forth and so on. So they're always fighting and murdering to get hold of the royal jewels or the king's jewels and so forth. I didn't tell you about my getting the Tsar's jewels, did I? No, that's another story. Really, really and truly. that is something. Of course, I didn't get them, but the person who was with me was the Tsar. Well, thus they were very indolent people, many of whom did worship idols. Notice, many of whom did worship idols, and the curse of God had fallen on them because of the traditions of their fathers. They'd inherited it. They were barbarians. They had a variety of cults, you see. Many of them worshiped idols, notwithstanding the promises of the Lord. Now the sons of Mosiah went to preach to these people, and that was going to be a job, that they might bring them to know the plan of redemption. So they separated, every man alone. Well, that's a risky thing. But on my mission, I never had a companion. I got President Chadji's permission to go alone. Nobody else would go to the bicycle. Nobody else would go to the Black Forest. Nobody else would go to these stews and places. So I had to go alone. And it was very interesting. Then, of course, after I distributed After I distributed the tracts and rented the beer hall, then I would bring in Brother Loscher, one of our high-powered German orators, and he'd come in and preach at the meeting. He'd convert them. I just got him out to the meeting. Yeah, he was a great speaker, that Brother Loscher. And then he came to Salt Lake. He became a photographer some years ago. Then Ammon blessed them, being the chief among them. He blessed them and sent them on their ways. Now, Ammon went to the land of Ishmael. Here's another nice little insight we have here. Remember, the sons of Ishmael joined later, daughters of Ishmael, his families of Ishmael. Notice they were the first to break away and join the Levites. That certainly indicates, doesn't it, that they were of the tribe of Ishmael. See, the Ishmaels were the Arab tribes. And they went back, remember, was half Manasseh. Lehi himself was half Manasseh, and Manasseh was the desert tribe. Half Egyptian, half Arab is what they amount to. And they were east of the Jordan, you see. And when they went out to pick up Ishmael and the son Ishmael, they came down and joined them. And notice, when they were still in the desert, it was Laman, Lemuel, and daughters of Ishmael that revolted against the family, against Lehi. And now, later on, we find in the Book of Mormon, the Ishmaelites are a people separate by themselves. They've kept their identity. Throughout this race, as I say, the race problem in the Book of Mormon is very complex. And here again, Ammon went to the land of Ishmael, the land being called after the sons of Ishmael, who also became Lamanites. They were the first to defect from Lehi and Nephi. And Ammon entered the land of Ishmael, and their custom was to bind any Nephite who came along. That was a regular custom. That's established. And retain them in captivity. And thus Ammon was... Well, this is so with many Indian tribes, of course. You come into the land, read the life of Hamblin. Jacob Hamblin is very exciting on that subject. Some of the other brethren. Ammon was carried before the king, who was of the land of Ishmael, and his name was Lamoni, and he was a descendant of Ishmael. So it was Ishmaelite blood that bound them together here. There was one family thing, but he was probably the chief of the family because he was a literal descendant. They would have gathered many others. Remember, this is a very fluid society this way. And he asked him what he wanted, and Ammon said, I desire to dwell among the people for a time, yea, perhaps until the day I die. And Ammon said, well, you're welcome to take one of my daughters to wife. But Ammon said, no, I want to be thy servant. I want to watch the flocks of Lamoni. And now we come to the story of the waters of Seba. It's a very interesting thing. You know, I didn't bring the book along. Is it going to tell about that? Well, that's all right, because it's all perfectly clear here. But in that book that just came out, I can't remember the title of it, of the Book of Mormon. The prophetic Book of Mormon. No, it's not the prophetic Book of Mormon. It's this other one. It's the last one, yeah, the last one to appear. I don't even know the title. I only saw it once. But it has a section on the battle by the waters of Cephas. Now, the idea is this. They have the funniest battle you can imagine. It's absolutely crazy, and this is what happens. You know, well, let's see what happens here. He's going to watch the flocks. The waters of Cephas, where all the Lamanites would drive their flocks hither that they might have water. So this must have been dry country. All the people, it was the main watering place, and they all drove their flocks together there. And then they would do a funny thing. They would have the strangest sort of fight there. A certain number of Lamanites, now whether that was a limited number or not that was required by the game, because it's a game they're going to play, of the Lamanites who had been with their flocks to water, and stood scattering the flocks of Ammon, the servants of the king. Well, that's a funny thing. They brought their flocks, and then they scattered the flocks of Ammon, the servants of the king. Now, the servants of the king began to murmur, saying, now the king will slay us, as he has our brethren. Well, this would happen, and they'd take the flocks away, and then the servants would go back, and they'd get executed for that, and then these people come out, and it happens again. Doesn't the king have enough servants to protect his flocks there? Do they have to... They have to do this and then have them all killed and the next route killed. They are sorry because of it. They will slay us as he has slain our brethren because their flocks were scattered by the wickedness of these men. They began to weep exceedingly. They didn't want to be executed because they'd lost the game. Now they wept for fear of being slain. When Amma saw this, his heart was swollen. He wasn't going to have this sort of thing. conceit was routine. He would say, I'll show forth my power unto these my fellow servants, he says, which he does. He's going to restore the flock. Came to Platt's. He gave them a peck pop. He warmed them up. He flattered them by his words. Come on, boys, let's get them. And he said, let's go in search of the flocks, and we'll gather them together, and we'll bring them back to the place of water, and we'll preserve the flocks, and the king won't kill us after all. So he talks to them like the coach, you see. And then they have the contest. They follow Damon, and he rushed forth with much swiftness at the head of the flocks of the king, gathered themselves together again. And then they stood to scatter the flocks. The men came again to scatter the flocks. So they line up, they're going to scatter the flocks again. But Ammon said unto the brethren, you take care of the flocks. You encircle them round about. They won't run away this time, and I'll go and take care of these people. So he does. He calls a new play. He's got a new game plan now, you see. Therefore, they did as Ammon commanded, and he went forth and stood to contend with those who stood by the waters of Sebus. This is a separate game now. The sheep were out of it. There's going to be a combat here. And it says they like to play this game, and they played it for fun here. The next verse tells us that. Neither did they know anything concerning the Lord. Therefore, they delighted in the destruction of their brethren, and for this cause, they stood to scatter the flocks of the king, to have the fun of killing a lot of Nephites. That's a fun game to play, wasn't it? They delighted in this. That's the reason they stood there to scatter the flocks. Now we're going to see that all of this is a perfectly legitimate game, and you can find at least 100 parallels to it if you look for it. This is the way it used to be done. But don't get ahead of the game here. But Ammon, he's not going to play fair. He stood and began to cast stones at them with his sling, like Reuben Hedlock. My mother's great uncle was Ed Sloan, and his missionary companion was Reuben Hedlock. And Reuben Hedlock was the man who made the engravings for the Pearl of Great Price, engravings of the facsimiles for the Pearl of Great Price. And they were Irish, and they went on a mission in Ireland. And of course, they were mobbed. And I just stumbled across this letter the other day, just quite accidentally. It was in a wastebasket, as a matter of fact, in genealogy wastebasket. And here was this letter written by Ed Sloan about him and Reuben Hedlock and what they'd done. Well, they said they started chasing them down the street, throwing stones at them, and suddenly they stopped and said, now, just a minute, we're Irish too, and we can throw a lot better than those characters and all these nice cobblestones here. So they started throwing back, and they sent three of them to the hospital, and they chased the mob back. They were picked up for riotous behavior and so forth, but released when some of the, I say, our sports in a way, don't deal with them though, got them released. But they were able to drive off the mob because they could throw too. See, it works both ways. I think they're more surprised than anything else to find these guys. But they'd both been herding sheep most of their life and had a deadly aim, you see. Out with doing nothing but throwing rocks all day, like sheep herders, both slings and rocks. So they were from Sanpete, from Manti, brother. Hedlock was from Manti. My great-great-uncle was from Manti. Well, this is what happens here. He goes out and starts throwing rocks at them, and he's deadly with it, you see, with his sling. And slingers, as you know, are deadly people who spend... See, Ammon had spent... Well, he spent a lot of time. I don't know whether it was 14 years or not on a mission. I remember they took the weapons with them to hunt game. And men shepherds in Greece have nothing to do, or in Spain, have nothing to do all day but practice with slings. And so they become deadly accurate. And the most effective troops in any ancient army were the slingers, the line of slingers. Because they would sling pellets, and these pellets are found by the thousands throughout the ancient world. They do lead pellets, very little air resistance, and they really go. They're more deadly than a 22, easily, I think. And they could hit anything. No wonder little David, who had been not so little after all, had been tending flocks all his days, was awfully good with the sling and knew just where to knock Goliath out. So the same thing happens here. This man is deadly. And he began to cast his stones at them, and he slew a certain number by slingery. And they began to be astonished. This wasn't according to the game. They hadn't expected that. The next verse. Seeing that they could not hit him with their stones, he was out of range. He was a good slinger, eh? Not hit him with their stones, they came forth with clubs to stay him. It was a stone-throwing contest, which was fair enough, because they had stones too, it says here. But after the stone-throwing, they came after him with their clubs. But every man that would lift his club to smite Ammon, he smote off their arms with his sword. Now, there's only one way you can do damage with a club. You can't poke with it, can't trip up with it. You have to lift your arm to hit with it. That's all there is to it. And so he had this trick blown. He just cut off their arms. It was a very neat operation. It could be done. Now, well, we'll mention later, an Aztec game that's done with this, prisoners of war. One person would have a club, and the other person would have a sword. And the person with the club was tied by his ankle. He could have only limited range. See, he was a prisoner. It was supposed to be a sacrificial thing anyway. He only had a club to defend himself, whereas the other was an armed man with a sword or with a club with obsidian blades on it, very sharp obsidian blade. So the other person didn't have a chance, unless he was awfully good, you see. But it was the club against the sword, you see. And that was supposed to be done. This person was supposed to be killed. It was a ritual sacrifice. You say, why do they do these bloody things? It's the sanest form of war there is, to limit the bloodshed. We don't have that. We kill everybody, you see. Now, have you seen plenty of documentaries about wild animals and savage wars? You notice they fight often, but they know when to stop. The elk will fight, sometimes bloody fights, and hippopotamuses and sea lions and so forth. They fight like crazy to be head of the herd and so forth, but when the time comes, they stop and they break it up. And the same thing with savage warheads. The Indians have their touch stick. You touch so many people and that's it. It's settled as far as you've killed so many. A certain price, a certain honor has to be paid. And of course, that's what the duel is. Some blades, you draw blood, and that's the honor has been satisfied. The types, I have a long list of such types here. I'll not get into them. But the point is that these are ways of keeping down the killing. That's it. You know, since you're going to war and since your tempers are high, somebody must pay, but how much, you see? Do we have to wipe out the whole nation? Do we have to get wiped out completely before our honor is satisfied? We have that absurd expression, you know, unconditional surrender. Well, a person doesn't surrender unless there's a condition that his life is spared. He's not going to surrender at all unless he surrenders on condition. So when we say unconditional surrender, that's an Irish bull, an oxymoron. Well, we get into these things rather here. I see the time is up now, but, well, there's more. I have a more elaborate thing, but I'll take it about the next time. But first here, let's finish this chapter. How about that? So they began to be surprised, and they began to run away from him. I don't blame them. And they were not a few in number, and he caused them to flee by the strength of his arm. Six of them had followed by the sling each other. He slew none of them, save it were their leader with the sword. He only dueled with the leader with the sword. See, the whole point of these things is between the leaders. It's a duel, is what it is, you see. And the duel comes forth. See, David and Goliath. As soon as Goliath was finished, then the Philistines surrendered. There was no battle. That ended it. That's the Homeric War, too. The heroes decided to fight, and the whole issue of the war depends on them. And the one who wins takes over the army of the other without any trouble at all, and that happens in the modern European wars, even the great wars, the devolution, Austrian succession, and so forth. The winner, the prince, took over the lands and everything else. That was their purpose, to take as many lands as they could. This idea of total warfare is, as Clausewitz says, an utter absurdity. It's just armies that are fighting, and when you reach the point when you have subjected the enemy to your will, the war is over. What you're trying to do is get him to do what you want him to do. And when he's willing to do that, there's no need for any more. He said, we don't do that anymore. We have body count now. We just keep on counting as if that was a sign of victory. He has a wonderful thing to say about that. Clausewitz, the great warrior's Bible, you know, written in it. Wasn't published till 1833. I gave a spiel on that on Friday night. That's not what got me onto this, but it is the thing. See, I used to have I think I've worked at every level of intelligence, from company right up to chief. I worked quite a while in the British War Office, Whitehall. Very few people could get into Whitehall. Oh, that's a joke, that's something. Hyde Park Corners, where all the intelligence was cooked up in London there. Frequent visits to Shape, but to Maidenhead, went down to Maidenhead to steal maps and things like that, because you had to steal information if you wanted it. They wouldn't give it to you in those British. At other levels, and then naturally at division levels, that's where I was stuck for a whole year, at the division level, but then it was with the 101st, and that means we had to be very active, and my business was to report everything that was going on from minute to minute. Be very exposed. And that meant you had to go down, and you had to circulate and visit and go behind and go through the woods and do as much peeking as you could and so forth, all this sort of nonsense. But it was nice to observe war at every level, you see. And then some of it absolutely magnificent, these huge, unspeakably dramatic, far more dramatic than Hollywood ever made it as far as a spectacle is concerned, when you see the drop of 1,000 on the 4th of July. To make an impression on the Germans, we sent over 5,000. I don't remember whether it was 5,000 or 50,000 planes yet. It was one or the other, but they sent over 5,000 planes, just in one bunch, showed them. And everybody looked up, hey-ho, and nobody bothered about it again. So they have a lot of planes. You see, it isn't the size, it isn't It's like the second coming. It won't be the display. It's not the Sidney Spielberg effect or the Paul Lucas that we're after. Those things fall flat. I mean, the special effects are not the thing at all. It's what we feel in ourselves that goes on. That's where it is. And I don't know, I shouldn't have got off on this, but I had one great privilege to visit the same places militarily that I had visited as a missionary when you go to a village. And it's infinitely harder to go through a hostile village as a missionary than it is to go through the same village with an M1 ducking from door to door. It takes far more courage because that's what the war is about. As Clausewitz says, it's a conflict between their mind and your mind, to look him in the eye. You see, this is the thing. You're preaching the gospel and you feel that opposition. This was very hostile territory. See, it was very strong Catholic. They would send, they announced before, they'd warned the people against us and so forth, and to go there. And then, you see, we're not supposed to contend, we're not supposed to argue about tenets, we're simply supposed to bear your testimony and be on your way. But the tension, the resistance, the overpowering, the power that was there, see, without any weapons or anything like that, that wasn't it at all. And I believe the war in heaven, they used no weapons at all. Of course they didn't. We're told that Satan was cast down in a twinkling. That wasn't it at all. I mean, the Lord could squish Satan like a bug anytime he wanted to. That's not it, you see. These things, it all takes place in the realm of the mind, of the spirit. We're eternal spiritual beings, and we have to go through this stuff. And this is a very interesting process we're going through right now, a brief and temporary one. It's a great one. Well, I'll resume with this comedy tomorrow. It's quite a thing, this Seabus business, what they do.